I don't know of any greater person we could have to talk to us tonight than our speaker. And it gives me a great deal of pleasure. I consider it a distinct honor to present to you Marty Mann.
I like that. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
And I thank you, Jim. Well, you did pretty well. I'll never forget that one introduction. I've had a few that were almost that bad, and they don't help. I should start properly. My name is Marty Mann, and I'm an alcoholic. And I've thought quite a lot about what I was going to say tonight. Personally, I feel a great responsibility. So many people here have not heard me before, and so many people here have told me how much they wanted to and how much they've heard about me, and it kind of strikes the fear of God in you, let me tell you. I get nervous every time I get up to speak before an ordinary audience, you know, my regular job. But I don't usually get quite that nervous in an AA group, but I do tonight. Jim said there was some water here. That may help me. Anyway, I had come to the conclusion that the best thing I could do was the simplest thing, which was to tell my own story, and most particularly what AA has meant to me, how that meaning has changed over the years, and why. And then I saw that film this afternoon. I don't know if everyone, I know you didn't all see it, but perhaps those of you who didn't see it this afternoon have seen it somewhere else. It's Bill's own story. It wasn't so much the story, I know that by heart, but it was seeing Bill and hearing him, and it's awfully good of him. It's very lifelike. And as he got up and walked out the door and then walked up the hill into the woods where he has a little cottage where he did his writing, I couldn't believe I'd never see him again. And I was broken up. And so I thought I'd do something a little different from what I had planned. Not that I plan too much before I give an AA talk, because I've always been of the opinion that a good AA talk comes from the heart more than from the head, and that those who plan too long and too carefully somehow plan the life out of their talk. So I've never planned, and I rarely know what I'm going to say ahead, but I do have some general idea. And you know, in recent years, there have been all kinds of small changes in AA in different parts of the country. I was a little surprised, for instance, the first meeting here to hear that response to the "Hi, everybody," because that's Western. I had a little experience about that during my recuperation from the accident where I fractured my hip. I lived 4 months in Tucson. And I went to a meeting nearly every night in the week in my wheelchair. It meant a very great deal to me. Thank God I could do that, because I wasn't a bit happy about being grounded. And I still wasn't awfully sure that I was going to walk properly again. Turned out all right, as you've observed. But that's the way they do it out there. They don't say the "Hi, everybody," but the minute you say, "My name is Marty Mann and I'm an alcoholic," everybody says, "Hi, Marty." And you get used to it. Well, I went back east in the summer, and not long thereafter I went to a meeting, and the speaker said, "My name is so-and-so and I'm an alcoholic," and I said, "Hi, so-and-so." All by myself. And I told them afterwards, because they were kidding me, I said, "Well, you know, it's a nice thing to do. It makes the speaker feel very warm and very wanted. And I think we ought to break down from our Eastern reserve and adopt one of these Western things. Now I can say they do it in the South, too. So who do we think we are in the Northeast, anyway?" But one of the things that has grown up in New York in recent years is a requirement for a speaker. We didn't used to have requirements. But you know, There are always periods when AAs get awfully full of business about rules and regulations. I can remember back to the time when some groups drew up bylaws, and they had rules and regulations. And I remember Bill saying if that had been around when he came in, he'd never have made it. He wouldn't have gone in. Because most alcoholics really don't care very much about that. However, at the moment, this is pretty much a rule throughout New York City, where I go to quite a lot of meetings. You must qualify. By God, if you don't qualify, you can't speak. And qualify, of course, means prove your right to be a member of AA. How drunk did you get? How often? When? Where? And how much did you drink? There was a time when people got tired of drunkalogs, and we used to hear a lot about doing something else other than a drunkalog, and you aren't expected to talk too long in this qualifying bit. Not your whole talk is not to be made up of it, of course, but that, in a sense, is another way of saying that they're telling their story, explaining how it is that they came to be eligible for AA. And I had thought of doing that tonight. But I think I'm just going to rest on your belief that I'm eligible. I am, believe me. I was not a high-bottom drunk. I lost everything. When I finally got into a hospital in New York, everything I had in the world was in two suitcases. I had very few friends left. I really was down and out. Because of that, the first hospital I went into was Bellevue. Now, that's a city hospital. And I only got in there by good luck. I had met a girl during a period when I was trying to stop drinking, whose family were very wealthy and who had lots of troubles in their family, including a great deal of alcoholism. And she was impressed with my efforts. And she asked me if I would accept a Christmas present for her of an appointment with the man, the doctor, who had taken care of so many of her family. Well, I knew his name. He was internationally famous. And I said I would indeed accept it. And one reason that I was happy to do this was that because I had come back from Europe a year before, convinced that I was insane, and I think that's true of many of us, I didn't know what was wrong. I'd never heard the word alcoholism or the word alcoholic. And I couldn't understand why my drinking had changed. I think this is very baffling to most of us. Because I'd been a good, average alcoholic. The first 10 years of my drinking, I gave every appearance of drinking like everybody else. In fact, I outdrank everybody else. I could drink more and hold it than anyone. And when I was growing up, that was something to be immensely proud of. You know, people patted you on the back. The boys complained that I was an expensive date. But they seemed to like that. And I grew up in Prohibition. During that time, if you didn't drink, you didn't get dated. And if you were a boy who didn't have a flask, girls wouldn't go out with you. So it was the thing to do, and I was simply doing what everybody else did. But I discovered right off the bat that I had a phenomenal capacity. I could drink and drink and drink and drink and not show it. So I was always the one that drove everybody home. I was the one that remembered everything that had happened. And I was thought to be a great drinker. And I'm just going to tell you one little story about that. This lasted for 10 years, but this is about in the middle of it. There was apparently some boasting by a young man I was going out with about my capacity, which was considered so great. And another man, and this was just a group of men talking, gave him an argument and said there was another girl that was a better drinker than I was. Well, the argument waxed hot and heavy, and bets were made on which of the two of us was the best drinker. And you know, over $5,000 was wagered on this. So something had to be done to settle these bets. And a party was planned in the house of the other girl it was being bet on, which was her in-law's home. It was a great big house on Lakeshore Drive in Chicago. And the elders of the family were away. So the house was all ours. And this party was set up, and a committee of three was selected to be the judges, and they were not permitted to drink anything at all. Their job was to watch Gladys and me. The drink was settled upon, and it was French 75s. Do any of you remember what those were? Gin and champagne, highball. The gin at that period in time was mostly made in the bathtub, but the champagne in that house was excellent, so it was quite a palatable drink. That's all we were to drink, and we were to match each other drink for drink. I guess there were about 50 people invited to this party, and it was a very gay and hilarious party. I distinguished myself a couple of times during the evening. The drinks were set up down in the cellar, which had an immense kitchen and a big servants' dining room, and it seemed a good place to set out the food. We didn't want servants, you see. They'd all been dismissed. We wanted to be free to do what we wanted. And there was a young man in the group that played the piano very well. The piano was upstairs on the ground floor of the house. But he got down there in the bar, and he couldn't be detached from the bar, and we wanted him to go back and play the piano, and he wouldn't. So I picked him up and carried him upstairs, sat him on the piano bench. Well, you know what liquor does, gives you false strength, but it really worked. There was another discussion about how far up in the house the dumbwaiter went. There was an old-fashioned dumbwaiter in the kitchen down there. And I said, well, I'll find out. So I climbed in the dumbwaiter, and they ran me up to the top of the house. That's where it went. And down again. Well, these are the kind of silly, stupid things you do when you're drinking. And about 3 o'clock in the morning, there were quite a few bodies lying around, and a number of people had left. Well, there was still a handful, so we went on a bit longer. And at 5 o'clock in the morning, Gladys and I and the three judges went out and had a big breakfast. It was a draw. We had drunk drink for drink from 6 o'clock to 5 in the morning. And I never drank slowly. Neither did Gladys. And you know, for years, I expected at some meeting she was going to come up and say, here I am. Since she hasn't done that, I suspect she didn't live to make it, because I have no doubt whatsoever that she, too, was an alcoholic. She was only a little older than I, and that capacity that we both had was anything but normal. Nevertheless, I had it for 10 years. And then in the course of 1 year, it changed. And I think many of you know what happened, or will remember what happened. The first thing I noticed was blackouts. And the first time I had one, I had recently fallen and hit my head, and I thought I had concussion. So I went to see a doctor. He said, yes, you have concussion. You better not drink for a week or two. So I didn't. He said, then you'll be all right. It's not very serious. Well, in a few weeks, I had another blackout. These are very frightening. And I didn't know what to do about that one, because supposedly the concussion was all over. And I went along, and in due course, I had another one. At the same time, I began to have hangovers. I'd never had a hangover. I could always get up and shake my head and go to work or set about whatever I was doing for the day. And I had no suffering at all from the amount I'd consumed the night before. But suddenly, I had hangovers. And I've always felt there ought to be a different word for what happens to us, because they bear little resemblance to what most people call hangovers. Ours are epic. You wish you were dead. It's too bad, very often, you think that you can't die. You feel that sick. An ordinary person would call the doctor, go to a hospital, believe me. But we don't. It's just part of the price we're paying, and we take it, and we go on. And then I discovered that I could deal with these hangovers with hair of the dog. And that settled that, excepting the capacity was still there. And it took over a pint before I could put my feet on the ground. Well, that meant that by the time I got dressed, I'd had a pint, or a little over, and it was beginning to wear off, and I had to have some more. And bang, I was hooked. That lasted for 5 years, being in that spot. And it got worse and worse and worse. And the things I did and the things I said and the things I didn't know whether I'd done or said and the things that might have happened when I didn't know what had happened, these were an immense burden to carry. And I couldn't figure it out. And of course, people who knew me used to say, "Why don't you drink the way you used to?" This is just what I wanted to know. Why couldn't I drink the way I used to? I think this is something that happens to many of us. I think it holds us back, often, from seeking help. I think it holds us back from recognizing what's happened, or knowing that when it's happened, it's for good. There's no turning back. We keep thinking we can. And like most of us, I kept trying. The one thing that never occurred to me was to stop drinking altogether. Of course, I couldn't imagine a life without drinking. I had been drinking ever since I started having dates and going out, because I discovered that this was what kept me from being tongue-tied and a bump on a log. I was afraid of people unless I'd had drinks. I couldn't mix with them. I didn't feel comfortable with them. So right away, I had been dependent on drinking. But I didn't think of it in those terms. And I honestly didn't know what was happening. I think it's twice as frightening if you don't. And I had come to what I think is a quite natural conclusion, which was that I was insane. I was living in England. And as I became more and more convinced that this was what was wrong, I sought help from two or three psychiatrists in London. They all told me I was having a nervous breakdown. I was burning the candle at both ends and this, that, and the other. And I came to the conclusion that they weren't telling me the truth. And that quite clearly, one of them was going to, when I finally found the right one, was going to lock me up somewhere for keeps. And if that was going to happen, I'd better go home. It was not easy. But I finally managed to get back to America. I'd made a lot of promises to myself. I was going home. I'd been away for 7 years. And everything was going to be different. And I was going to make a fresh start. I'd been doing the geographic cure within Great Britain. I'd lived in several parts of England, and I'd lived in Scotland. And that hadn't done anything. I don't know why I thought going home would do it, but I'd sort of figure out for myself that maybe the trouble was I was rootless. I pulled up my roots, and I'd better go home where I belonged and get my roots down, and then everything would be all right. So I wasn't going to drink going home. That was the beginning of the new life. I was poured on the boat, of course. And you know, 7 years away and really wanting to go home, I never saw the skyline when the boat came into New York. I didn't know we'd landed. I was the last one off the boat, and I was carried off. And for the next year, I was solidly drunk in New York. But I felt that I had to find help. I'd been looking for it in England. I hadn't found it. I felt now I should do it in New York. And in the course of that year, I had seen 7 different psychiatrists because I thought I was a mental case. That's who I went to. I was perfectly honest about my drinking. It didn't occur to me not to be, because that's why I thought I was insane. So I had to tell it to explain to them. None of them would take me on. They were all honest psychiatrists. And in the 1930s, they didn't know what to do with a drunk. They really didn't. So they would all tell me they couldn't help me. And when I'd say, "Well, what should I do?" And they said, "Well, you'd better commit yourself to a state institution." And I'd say, "For how long?" And they would either evade that question, or one of them finally said, indefinitely. Well, then I knew that what I feared was true. They just weren't telling me the truth. It was too awful for them to tell me. But clearly, I was had the kind of insanity that meant that if I did go into one of these places, I'd never come out. And I had the usual misconceptions about what a mental institution was. That was the period when they spoke of snake pits. And I was a little afraid. So every time this was said to me, I'd go out of that office and I'd head for the nearest bar and I'd drink as many double martinis as I had money for to forget what I'd been told. And then I'd go on my merry way until it got so bad I had to find another one. The man I referred to earlier was the eighth one. And he said something to me. He said, I don't think you're insane. I'm not going to put you in a psychiatric hospital or a psychiatric ward. But he said, you're broke. And I'm the head of the Department of Neurology at Bellevue, and I can put you in Bellevue if you'll go. And I said, yes, I'll go. Well, he said, I'm doing this in spite of the fact that in my experience, people like you, that was all I was ever called for the next few years, people like you have one chance in 100. But you want to get well so badly, I think maybe you're that one, and I'm going to take a chance on you. Well, I would have gone anywhere. Because the nightmare that I'd been living in, really, for 5 years, was more than I could take. I wanted no more of it. I tried suicide twice, incidentally, during this period, and hadn't succeeded. I knew that the third time I'd have to succeed unless something else happened. So I went into Bellevue, in the neurological ward, 34 beds. I was there 7 months. And my doctor came there twice a week, and he'd sit by my bed for 10 or 15 minutes and talk. And I don't know why I knew enough to tell him that I wasn't ready to leave. I was scared to leave, tell the truth, because he always asked me, do you feel better now? Do you think you can go out? And I told him, I said, you know, if everything goes all right, everything goes well, I might make it. But if anything goes wrong, I'll be right back where I was. And I didn't want to risk it. And I still was convinced, in spite of what he'd said, on top of all the others, that what I needed was psychiatric treatment, because what had gone wrong was in my head. And it had to be put right if I was to get well. And finally, I persuaded him that this was what I had to have. And he made arrangements for me to get into a private sanitarium in Connecticut. I was accepted there. The medical director, Dr. Thibault, was my psychiatrist. And after 7 months in Bellevue, going up there was like going to heaven. Beautiful place, 500 acres. And I saw Dr. Thibault every day. And that's what I had wanted. And I thought, now I've got it made. Now everything's going to be fine. Well, I arrived up there the end of June. Dr. Thibault, unfortunately, took July for his vacation. And right after I got there, I had met several people that seemed to be my kind of people. They were all alcoholics. Two women and a man. They had different doctors. They didn't have Dr. Thibault. Their doctors were teaching them how to drink. And I figured I had the wrong doctor. Well, one of the doctors, the man and one woman, were patients of this man, who incidentally is a very eminent doctor. He's become a great friend of mine since, but was looking at a place, thinking of starting a place up in the Adirondacks. And transferring all his patients to this other place, and he wanted these two patients to see it. So he invited them to drive up to the Adirondacks, and they said they wouldn't go without me. Well, Thibault was going away on vacation, so he said it was okay, so I went off with them, and we drove up to the Adirondacks with this psychiatrist. And we looked at this place, and we went out on the lake with... He met two other psychiatrists up there. We felt a little uncomfortable with three psychiatrists. Then this man did something that showed me, at least, now that he didn't know a damn thing about alcoholics. He said he had to get down to Philadelphia in a hurry, and he was going by train, and would we take his car back to Connecticut? So the three of us took his car back to Connecticut. It took us 9 days. We had a system, though. Every time we left someplace, we'd call the sanitarium and say, "We're at so-and-so, we're just leaving." So they never knew where we were, and they never could catch us. And we had adventures that I won't go into. Anyway, the three of us got back right after the 4th of July, and my two sisters had come up to visit me, and they'd been there without me, and the three of us came in, somewhat the worse for wear, and were all put to bed. And the worst of that was that their doctor was there, and he absolved them right away. My doctor was away. I couldn't get absolved. And I had to sit around bearing my load of guilt until he came back from vacation. It was a hell of a way to begin a place and stay in a new place. That, I think, for anyone with anything else except alcoholism would have taught them a lesson. It didn't teach me one. I didn't, naturally, have anything to drink for quite a while after that because I didn't have the opportunity. But as time went on, I was given a good deal of freedom, and I'd go into New York to go to a theater or go to the dentist or to stay with my sister, or something like that. And 9 times I'd come back all right, and the 10th time I'd come back drunk. And then Dr. Tebow and I would try to figure out what had happened, and we never could. Looking back, I know what was happening. I really was learning a lot from him. I was learning a lot about myself, what pushed me around by the nose, my emotions, my motives, my difficulty in getting along with people, all that kind of thing I was learning about. And I thought, well, I'm getting better. And of course, as I get better, I'm going to be able to drink again. So I was testing it out. It never worked. That didn't teach me a thing, though. I just worked harder with him. Finally, he said to me, "You know, I'm doing my best." And he said, "You're certainly cooperating. But I don't think I'm doing much for you. If you get drunk again, I'm just going to have to say it's no use." I'd been there, well, I guess it was about 9 months then. And I was scared because I didn't know where else I'd go or what else I'd do. This was in 1938. You'd have thought that I was scared enough so that I wouldn't drink again, but not at all. When I did come back and I'd been drinking, I just took greater care not to get caught, and I had made friends with everybody on the place by that time. And some of the nurses would sneak me in the back way and put me in a shower and fill me full of hot coffee and not let me out of my room and so on. And I thought I was getting away with it. But I was scared. And one day, I had a message that Dr. Tebow, I knew he'd been homesick for a week, would like me to come and see him at his home. And I thought, this is the end. He's going to throw me out. So in fear and trembling, I went down to his house. He was still in bed. He was recovering from a bad virus attack. And he was sitting up in bed, and on the bed was a strange-looking object. Two red cardboard covers fastened together with those wire rings. And it was lying open on the bed in front of him, and he said, "I have been reading something written by people like you, and it looks as if they have something, and I think maybe they can help you, and I want you to take this and read it." And he handed it over to me. And the title was Alcoholics Anonymous, which didn't mean much to me at that point. I really didn't know the word alcoholic or what it meant. But I was delighted that I wasn't being thrown out. So I grasped at it, and he said, "Now you go home and read it, and I'll be back. I'll be back at the office in a couple of days, and we'll talk about it." So I took it, and I think I must tell you how I came to get it. When the book was completed, Bill and the others, and Bill was the major one who was getting this book together, but everybody had a say about it, both in Akron and New York. They felt that they wanted nothing in that book that would offend either the clergy or psychiatry, because those were the two sources from which they hoped to get people to work on, and they needed people to work on. So they decided to get it multilithed, the manuscript, and get 40 or 50 copies put together with these cardboard covers. Nobody had any money, so everything had to be done on the cheap. And then the members were going to try to find some clergymen and some psychiatrists who would be willing to read it and make comments. And one of the members had a sister-in-law in Greenwich who was very civic-minded and served on many boards. And she said, well, I serve on a board with a psychiatrist up here, and I think he's the kind of man that'd be willing to read it. So she took a copy, and she gave it to Dr. Thiebaud to read. And the minute he'd read it, he sent for me. This could be called coincidence. I have never felt it was that. I've always felt that there was a sort of guiding line in it and a purpose, because I was literally at the end of the road. Had I been thrown out of there, it would have been the end of me. That was the very last hope I had. And here was hope again. I was so excited, and I began to read that book. And here, for the first time, I read something about alcoholism. I found the word. I loved that word. You've no idea what I thought I was. I thought I had some form of insanity that was so awful that nobody could mention it. I didn't know what it was, but it was awful. It was nameless, at least. I was just people like you. They couldn't even say what it was. And to discover here that I had something that had a name was the greatest relief I'd ever had. I never can feel too sympathetic to people that fight the word alcoholic and the word alcoholism, just because I know how valuable it is to have those words. Valuable for us. I was delighted with them, and I started reading the book, and pretty soon, quite early in the book, I discovered something that made all the difference to me. You see, Dr. Thiebaud had been telling me from the time I went in there that I was the kind of person who couldn't drink, that I could never drink again. Now, the other doctors were all telling their patients that when the underlying disorder was cleared up, they could drink the way they used to. And I thought there was something wrong with Thiebaud. I remember asking him one day if he drank. And he said, he was a very honest man, well, I don't really like it. A little, once in a while, but I said, I thought so. Doesn't like it himself, doesn't want anybody else to have it. The other thing that bothered me was the mental picture of life without drinking. An endless, gray, flat desert. Nothing growing on it. Not even a horizon. Just endless and gray and flat. How could you live without drinking? And what did you do for friends? I had never liked teetotalers. You know, those good people with white teeth. You ever notice most alcoholics have terrible teeth? Till they get star ones. How was I going to make a life? With no fun in it, because I couldn't drink, and with no people that I could stand. It just wasn't reasonable. I couldn't do it. So naturally, I wanted to go to one of the other doctors who would teach me how to drink the way I used to. I couldn't do it. People wouldn't let go of me. But here in this book, he never could tell me why I couldn't drink again. He just said I couldn't. And you know, the theory the others worked on was a perfectly logical theory. If indeed alcoholism was the result of an underlying emotional disorder, then if you cleared up the underlying emotional disorder, you ought to be able to drink normally again. That's logic. And that's what all the other doctors were using. And you know, too many of them are still today. Only thing is, it doesn't work. Maybe logical, but it doesn't work. But those doctors who use that, I think, have been baffled, just as I was, in any kind of explanation that they could give people as to why they can't drink ever again. And here in the book, almost right away, I found it. It said alcoholism is a disease, first. That was good news to me, too. I wasn't just a no-good bum. I wasn't just willfully bad. But secondly, it is an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. We don't know what this allergy or sensitivity or whatever it is, we don't know what it is. And once you have it, you can't get rid of it. It's irreversible. So you're stuck with that body that will never again react normally to alcohol. This I could buy. The obsession of the mind, on the other hand, the book said, is something we can do something about. We have worked out a way to deal with that so that you don't have to drink against your own will and against your own self-interest, even when you don't want to. We can help you with the obsession of the mind. Well, it was the first time I had understood why I couldn't drink again, and I was able to accept it. But my happiness wasn't very long-lasting, because I began tripping as I read page to page over capital letters. And all the capital letters were G's. Now, I had outgrown God when I was 17. I wanted no part of that. Tebow had suggested a number of times that perhaps what I needed was religion. And I had said, no, you'll have to find something else. That's not for me. And I was very disappointed. And I went down to him and I said, well, it's too bad, but this is not for me. These people are engaging in self-hypnosis. And I can't do that. They're finding an emotional way out, and you've been telling me that's what's wrong with me. And so on, and so on, and so on. And this became a daily one-hour argument. While I told him what was wrong with the book and the idea, and he listened patiently and would occasionally try to set me right, and then he'd say, now go back and read some more. But going at that rate, I spent about a month getting one-third of the way through the book. And then something happened. Something that it says in the book must happen. A crisis came. It was a crisis that I felt responsible for. It wouldn't have happened if I hadn't been where I was. There was nothing I could do about it. I was totally, utterly helpless. It was like what Bill always described as being a wall which you couldn't get around or over or under. And in that crisis, I was angry as I had never been angry before. I was enraged. And I literally saw red. I always thought that was a figure of speech. It isn't. And I was in my room, which is a little tiny room up in the top floor of this building. And I was doing what every alcoholic does, because, you know, we're unusually intelligent people. I was so angry I wanted to kill this guy. So I thought, I'll go down to Koskob and I'll get two bottles of liquor. And I'll come back here and drink them and I'll bust up this place. Instead of going after him, I was going to get a hammer and beat my own brains out. That's how intelligent we always are. We always do it. Stop and think. That's why we can't deal with resentments. We always take them out on ourselves, not on anybody else. We hurt ourselves over and over and over again. And that's just what I was going to do. Well, while I was seething about this and making my plans, that book that I disliked so was lying on the bed, open. And out of the corner of my eye, I sort of saw the page, which was all blurred, because I wasn't really looking at it. And in the middle of the page, there were a few words that stood up as if they were block letters, black, carved. And they read, "We cannot live with anger." And I don't know why those were the words, but they were the battering ram that knocked down my resistance. And the next thing I knew, I was on my knees beside that bed. I guess I'd been there quite a while because the bedspread was wet with my tears. I guess I'd been praying, though I hadn't prayed since I was 16. I'd forgotten how. But when I lifted my head, it was a different world. It's not the kind of thing you can describe because there really aren't words for it, but my sensation was that I was not alone in that room and that I was utterly and completely free. I was so free that I looked at the little window under the eaves and I knew I could walk out of that third story window and keep on walking. I knew it. It was a wonderful feeling. And looking out of that little window, the grass had never looked so green and the sky had never looked so blue. Everything looked different. And then I stopped to think and I thought, well, now I really have gone nuts. And I ran downstairs because the doctor's offices were on the ground floor and I beat on Dr. Tebow's door and he came to the door and took one look at my face and he said, come in and tell me what happened. And he pushed a patient out the other door. And I told him. And he asked me a lot of questions. And I said, do you think I'm insane now? I said, I can walk out of that third story window. I can. He said, no, I don't think you're insane. He said, I believe you've had an authentic spiritual experience, the kind that William James wrote about in Varieties of Religious Experience. You better get it and read it. But meanwhile, he said, you go back upstairs and read that book. So I went back upstairs. And the second miracle occurred. Somebody switched books on me. This was a wonderful book. I hadn't liked the other one. I loved this one. I read it right through. And when I finished, I started at the beginning and I read it through again. And you know, I walked around that place. People told me that they went out of their way to catch a look at me, that my face was radiant. I've never been so happy in my whole life. Everybody looked beautiful. Everything was beautiful. But when Tebow suggested I should go to New York and meet those people, that was too much. And I kept putting it off and putting it off. It was over a month since this had happened. Before finally one day he picked up the phone and he said, she'll be in tonight. He gave me a card with an address on it. Said, you're taking the 5-something train and you go to this address on Sutton Place. And they'll take you to a meeting. Fear and trembling, I went. I was very surprised that I met a very nice couple and an extremely handsome young man. That made it very much easier. And we had a lovely dinner together. The two men were in AA. The woman was the wife of one of them. We got on the subway and went over to Brooklyn. That's where the meeting was. We met several people on that subway going over to Brooklyn for the same reason, and they told me afterwards I was the most wild-eyed dame they'd ever seen. Well, I didn't have an idea of what I was going to find. I was relieved by the two I'd met, the two men I was with. But I didn't know what might be there. I'd had all kinds of pictures. I thought they'd be praying mantises, and they'd pray over me. I thought most of them were really mission stiffs. In spite of the stories I'd read in the book, I couldn't believe they were really that nice, that they were my kind of people. So we arrived at this brownstone house in Brooklyn, and the door opened, and I'd never seen so many people as seemed to be milling around inside. And I rushed upstairs to leave my coat, and I didn't come down. I was scared to go down. And after a while, a very charming woman came up, and she put her arm around me, and she said, you know, we're waiting for you downstairs. We want you. We need you. Her name was Lois. She took me by the hand and led me downstairs. And I was surrounded by the men, all asking me questions. All the questions were about the same. When did you have your last drink? And to my utter amazement and horror, I told them the truth. This thing that I had been concealing so carefully, thinking I was getting away with, I told them the truth without even thinking. And far from being afraid of them, as I had always been, of new people. In no time flat, I was talking to them as if I'd known them all my life. They could finish my sentences. I could finish their sentences. We talked each other's language. And it suddenly dawned on me that I had found my own people at last. I had come home. That was the first great thing I found in AA. What you call fellowship. What we all call fellowship. The ease of communication we have with each other. The comfort we have in really knowing what's going on in the other person's mind. The trust that we give each other, as I did automatically when I told them the truth about when I'd had my last drink. All of these things I found for the first time in my whole life. And this was a group of strangers. At the end of the evening, there were really only about 25, maybe 30 people there, but it had looked awfully big to me. We went upstairs to their upstairs sitting room, a half a dozen of us. And I was the newest. I was the only one who was there for the first time, and I was full of questions. I really had read the book three or four times and knew sections of it by heart. And I started popping questions like mad, and finally Bill turned to me and he said, "You know, Marty, you don't have to do it all by Thursday." This was Tuesday night. But I always wanted to do everything by Thursday. He said, "Take it easy." And we began talking about resentments. I told him I'd never had a resentment. Never. And they all gaped at me. They said, "What do you mean you've never had a resentment? What did you have?" "Oh," I said, "I got hurt. Hurt feelings." Remember CB? Got his feelings hurt. That's just another way of saying resentment. But I hadn't known it. I began to learn some things about my own language and my own rationalizations to myself that very night. And that was the beginning of my embracing AA with both arms. The fellowship made it all easy. I loved the people. I still do, all of them, all of you. Because you are my people. I am home when I'm with you. And you know that's true on any place on the globe. It was true when I was with a group of Afrikaans-speaking Afrikaners in South Africa. I couldn't speak their language, and they couldn't speak mine. Well, they spoke a little English. But we were talking just the way we all do. They were AAs, and I was an AA, and that was enough. It was equally true in Australia, where their lingo, believe me, is something you can't understand. Try to understand what a speaker's saying. Their slang is something out of this world. It's true wherever you go. You're at home when you're with a bunch of AAs. You know, that is a kind of armor that I think many of us were looking for all through those years when we were putting up our defenses against everybody else and drinking to make our defenses stronger, to protect ourselves. Here we don't need to protect ourselves. Here we can trust. Here we can be exactly what we are, because that's all that's expected of us. Nobody need come in here under false colors. Nobody need to hold a mask up in front of their face because they're afraid somebody will see their real face. You can be you with all your faults and all your flaws and all your past, and nobody thinks any the less of you for it. The total acceptance that an alcoholic finds when he walks into an AA group is unlike anything that exists in the world for anyone else. Do you know how lucky we are? I've always said, from the first year that I was in AA, that I'm glad I'm an alcoholic. I'm grateful that I'm an alcoholic because of what I found in AA. And I know lots of people, new people, look askance at that, and they really don't believe you. You know, they just think you're making a phrase or you're boasting or something. But it's literally true. You realize what the rest of the world is doing now, trying to find out what we have and get it for themselves? Sensitivity groups, encounter groups, marathon groups. Ways in which people can feel closer to each other, can touch each other, can talk freely with each other. We don't have to do any of that nonsense. It happens in any AA meeting you go to. I think that's where they found out it could be done. But at any rate, it's something everybody wants. And we have it without even working for it. We have it by virtue of coming to AA and saying, take me in, I need you. Help me, I need you. And of course, when anybody says that, we try to help them. At least that's what we're supposed to do. I don't know when I was so pleased as I was when I saw the slogan that was used at the 30th anniversary in Toronto. That one, I am responsible. Because I think that's something we all have to remember all the time. It's awfully easy to get comfortable, so comfortable, that you don't want to disturb yourself going out on a 12-step call, seeing somebody who's in the throes, really sponsoring someone when it's inconvenient, it takes up time you want for something else. And if we don't go on doing that, AA will lose one of its most precious things. Here we have something that countless millions of people would like to have. We have been given a gift. We, who were the despised, the rejected, the ones that nobody wanted around, the hopeless ones, the disgusting gunks. That's what we were. Rejected by everybody. And we, these people, have been given a gift that some men and women study for 8 and 12 years trying to get. The gift of helping somebody else get well. Think of the years that doctors spend trying to become able to do that. Think of the years that nurses spend studying to get their degrees so they can do it, and psychologists and social workers. And we get it by virtue of walking into a meeting, asking for help, using that help when we get it, which means using the 12 steps, and then trying to pass it on to someone, and suddenly we see that many of the people we try to pass it on to actually get well. And we've had a finger in that pie. It has been through us. This is a very great gift we have. Let's not forget it. Let's not use it. Let's remember that it really is basic to this fellowship. The desire to help others. The willingness to help others. Of course, when I came in, I think like most of us, my main interest was just what's in the preamble. To get sober first, then to stay sober, and to help others achieve sobriety. And I really thought that was it. Of course, I'd read the 12 steps a number of times before I went to my first meeting. And I thought they sounded very nice. But then when I got there and we began talking about things, I found that the 12 steps were under discussion and that they meant a lot more than I had thought they meant. And I began to realize that I couldn't just read them through and say, well, I've done that now. But I was going to have to work at them, to really think deeply about them, and in many cases to take action about this or that step. We used to have a phrase we used a great deal in the early days of AA. Faith without works is dead. The works were the things we did to help alcoholics, as well as to help ourselves. And I think that's true. Faith without works is dead. That's a quotation from the scriptures. And I think it's something we need to remember. But I began to discover that instead of just being a way to stop drinking and stay stopped, which is what I thought it was, I had been got in here under false pretenses. That wasn't what AA was at all. I suddenly discovered that AA was not only a way of life, we hear that said very frequently, it was a means of growth, of internal growth, of emotional growth and spiritual growth, both. Because, you know, most of us, when we started to drink, whether it was at 15, 14, 17, whenever, mine was 17, immediately began depending on alcohol to do all the unpleasant things about growing up that other people were having to do for themselves. So we didn't grow up. We stopped dead at the moment we began to depend on alcohol. So we were like people where the needle got stuck in a groove. We'd grown chronologically. Our years had piled up. We might have grown intellectually a great deal. We might have a string of degrees. We might be brilliantly intellectual. But emotionally, we were exactly the age at which we first began to depend on alcohol. My case, 17. And I discovered that I had to grow up and that the 12 steps were going to be my tools for growing up and that I had to begin setting goals for what I wanted to achieve with myself. I discovered that alcohol is only mentioned in one of those 12 steps, the first. The rest of the steps aren't about drinking. They don't say a word about it. They were about me, what kind of a person I was. What was my relation to my creator or the universe or whatever I wanted to call God? What was my relation to other people? What was my relation to myself? What did I think of me? Was I comfortable with me? Certainly not. Never met a drinking alcoholic who was. One reason we drink. And I realized that that's what it was all about. Using these tools, which the 12 steps are, to grow up emotionally and spiritually. And of course, I still think that's what AA is all about. It is a program of growth. And I've watched it happen to people, hundreds and hundreds of them. And it's a fantastic thing to see. And I think it's happened a bit to me, too. Sometimes it slows down and you get stuck in a plateau and you get discouraged and depressed. But that's true of the learning process anyway. You shoot up for a while and then you level out. And it's almost as if you needed that time on a plateau to sort of sort out everything that had happened in the quick upbeat that you took at first. And I discovered that that could be lived with. You would think from the way I talked that just going to that meeting and finding the fellowship and coming to understand what the 12 steps were, that that was it. Alcoholism's not that simple. And we are not that simple. 8 months after I came into AA, I had a bad slip. I think that's very often a difficult period for new people. It was for me. I couldn't think for a long while why it had happened. Later, my hindsight began to show me some of the reasons why it had happened. One was awfully simple. I'd been so good for so long, and what the hell was it getting me? I wasn't having any rewards. I didn't have a job. I didn't have any money. My sister had gotten engaged, and I was a fifth wheel in my own home. Terrible. I couldn't stand it. But there's one thing I'll never forget that happened during that. And that was what that film today brought back to me so vividly. I hid out when I began to drink because I didn't want to be caught. And I had some friends up in Harlem, so I went up to Harlem. And there I stayed for about a week, I guess, until they got nervous and put me on a bus to send me home. And I don't know what happened. Apparently, I was brought home by a taxi driver. I don't know how I got off the bus in the taxi. I was in a blackout. And my brother-in-law-to-be called a few. He was in AA. He was the first person I brought in. Called a few others. And it took four of them to manage me, I gather, and they took me to Bellevue, not to the part I'd been in, the real hospital. They took me to what still existed in those days, the alcoholic ward. And it was hell. And I came to there the next day, and I won't describe it. Unbelievably awful. It was just before Christmas. The place was packed. They were sleeping on mattresses in the aisles. And they got us all out as fast as possible, and they let me out before anybody knew about it. So I got out on my own, and it was Sunday. And I had a little change in my pocket, not an awful lot. And all I wanted was to get something to drink. It was Sunday. And suddenly I had an inspiration. You could buy beer in a delicatessen on Sunday. So I went and got a six-pack. Well, then where was I going to drink it? Well, there was a girl I'd been trying to help who wasn't being helped at all. And I knew she'd welcome me with a pack of beer. So I went to her apartment, and indeed she did welcome me. And I holed up there, and we had a fine time. And nobody knew where I was. And I went out one day to get a bottle, and I was coming back, and there was a figure standing. This was an apartment house, not a very grand one, that had probably 24 names and buttons to push. And here was this tall, thin, shabby figure standing peering with all these names. And I noticed that his trousers were shabby. He had on a sailor's pea jacket that was too small. The sleeves came up to here. And his cuffs were frayed underneath it. He was pathetic. It was Bill. And I said, "What are you doing here?" He said, "I'm looking for you. Will you talk to me?" I said, "Well, I'm drinking." "Oh," he said, "I know that." I said, "Well, if you'll let me drink, I assure you can come up." The real reason I let him come up was I felt sorry for him. He looked so sad. So we went up to the apartment, and I had my drink. And he began to talk to me. And he said two things. He said, "I have a note here from Lois. They had lost their house in Brooklyn. The mortgage had been foreclosed. And they were living at that time in the summer cottage belonging to the mother of one of the members up in the Poconos." This was December. A summer cottage. He said, "I have a note from Lois, and we'd like you to come back with us if you'd like to. But," he said, "you know, it's not too comfortable. If you'd rather go in a hospital, we've raised the money between us to pay for you to go in town's hospital." That was the hospital where Bill had gotten sober. You had to pay the money on the nail before you were let in at town's, and it was quite expensive. And I choked up at the thought that that group, none of whom had any money at all, had somehow put together enough money to put me in that hospital. And I said, "No, I'll go with you, Lois." Also, Lois's note had said, "We want you up here because we love you." And then Bill turned to me and he said, "Do you want to go on drinking?" I said, "Naturally not." Well, he said, "I didn't think you did." He put his arms around me. He said, "You know, you and I have a long way to go together." That was the real thing. So I went up to the Poconos, and I had an awful time. He tapered me off. Took 3 days. Then I had a gallbladder attack. That was Ducky. And we all went down to the house of one of the AA members who lived. He had this great big old frame house near Nyack, New York. which had belonged to his wife's family, and it must have had 50 rooms in it. But they didn't have money to heat it all. They just had enough money to heat a few rooms on the ground floor, and the rest of the house was known as Siberia. And I was so sick that I was put in one of the rooms on the ground floor, but Bill and Lois had to go up to Siberia. And that house was full of drunks. They were sleeping all over the place. And I stayed there for another week or so, and the man of the house, who was the AA, had been off on a business trip. I was feeling very ashamed of myself and very badly about having put everybody to all that trouble, all the remorse that one has coming off a drunk. And they went to the train to meet Bob, who was coming back, and guess what? Bob was poured off the train. Well, he and I were so glad to see each other, you've no idea. He felt better that I was there coming off a drunk, and I felt better he'd come home drunk. That was the house where it was Bob who got opened up the big state hospital nearby, where they let him go over and talk to the drunks. And every Sunday afternoon, some of them came over to that house, and we began Sunday afternoon meetings that way. There were many things that happened in those early days that were wonderful and heartwarming and very exciting. Every one of us cared so desperately. And you know, we were all pretty uncertain. Nobody really knew whether this was going to work for keeps or not. So that every time anybody had a slip, everybody suffered, was shaking their own faith and their own sobriety. We don't have that anymore. We're pretty certain. Too many AA members have died after long years of sobriety, died sober, showing that you can stay sober for the rest of your life. We know it works. All we have to do is to do our part, whatever that is. Our share, whatever that is. We who were irresponsible, we who never took any responsibility, that's part of alcoholism. We have accepted the responsibility for ourselves to begin with and our own sobriety. And the responsibility of using that gift we've been given of helping other alcoholics. And never were we so needed. Don't forget that while we claim 500,000 members, I think we probably have more, but even if we did, that is the official figure from GSO. Don't forget that in these United States there are 9 million alcoholics. Take the 500,000 away. You still got 8.5 million out there suffering. And while I know that there are other ways of recovering, and I know people who have recovered other ways, I also know from my own experience that this is the best way. This is the way that will last you for life, that will support you for life, that will keep you growing for life, and will allow you to use that great gift for life. I think we have something so wonderful, so remarkable. I'm sorry for people that don't have it. We alcoholics have it in AA, Al-Anon members have it in Al-Anon. Al-Ateens can have it there, too. But what we've got is a bright spot in this very sorry world we live in today. Let's treasure it. Let's keep it bright. And let's pass it on. Thank you.